Story 1. We lived in a rundown house at the edge of a small town. I say we because it was me, my wife, and our little girl Emma. The place was a fixer-upper, but we got it cheap. There was something about it that just felt off, though. The kind of house that creaked at night when there was no wind. The kind of place where the silence felt too thick. I didn't think much about it at first. We were busy with life, trying to get by, and it was just a house. Emma was 4 at the time, a little bundle of energy, always running around, talking about her friends, all the usual stuff. But one day she came up to me, standing in the kitchen while I was making dinner, and said something that stopped me cold. "Jack says hi." I glanced over at her, chuckled a bit. "Who's Jack?" She gave me this look, like it was the most obvious thing in the world. "Jack, he lives under the porch." I wasn't a fan of imaginary friends. Maybe I was a bit of a skeptic. So I smiled and nodded, said something about Jack being a funny name, and went on with my day. But it wasn't long before things started to feel strange. Over the next few weeks, Emma would talk about Jack more often. She'd mention him out of nowhere. "Jack says you shouldn't be in the shed. He doesn't like people going in there." Or, "Jack says he's going to play with me in the dirt pile." At first, I brushed it off. Maybe it was just her imagination, the way kids can get so wrapped up in their little worlds. But then there were the nights. I started hearing things outside, quiet shuffling noises like someone was moving around under the porch. I'd open the door, peek out, and find nothing but the empty yard. It felt like someone was always just out of sight, watching. One evening, Emma was playing in the backyard when I heard her scream. It was a piercing, sharp scream that shot straight through me. I rushed outside, my heart in my throat. She was standing near the porch, her eyes wide with terror, pointing at the ground. "He's here! Jack's here!" I knelt beside her, trying to calm her down, but she wouldn't stop pointing. "Under the porch," and she kept saying, "he's right there." I was scared, I'll admit it. I didn't want to believe it. But something in her eyes, something in the way she was looking at the ground, made me feel like there was something more to it. I wasn't sure what to do, but I decided to check under the porch. Maybe there was something, an animal or a trick of the light. I grabbed a flashlight and crouched down, shining it under the wooden steps. Nothing. But then I heard it, a low, guttural laugh. It came from under the porch, close to my ear. It wasn't Emma. It wasn't a sound I could explain. It was dark, distorted, and bone-chilling. I froze. "Dad?" Emma whispered, her voice trembling. "Jack says he's hungry." I don't know how long I stood there just staring at the dark underbelly of the porch, but eventually I backed away slowly. I wasn't going to stay out there. I grabbed Emma and hurried her inside. I didn't know what was going on, but I wasn't about to stick around to figure it out. That night I lay awake, staring at the ceiling. The house felt colder than usual. It wasn't just the temperature. It was that feeling again. The feeling that something was watching. I could hear little scuttling noises, scratches like fingernails dragging across wood. I pulled the covers up to my chin, trying to block out the sound, but it kept going, louder now, moving across the walls of the house. I don't know how long I stayed like that, but I eventually drifted into a restless sleep. The next morning, Emma was quiet, too quiet. I found her standing by the back door, staring out at the porch. She didn't move when I called her name. "Emma?" She blinked slowly, like she'd been lost in thought. She turned to me and said, "Jack told me he wants to play with you now." I laughed nervously, trying to shake off the feeling creeping up my spine. "What do you mean, sweetie? Jack's just pretend, right?" She didn't answer. Instead, she just pointed outside. "Under the porch." I walked out with her, trying to push down the unease in my stomach. I wanted to tell her that Jack wasn't real. I wanted to tell her that she was just imagining things. But something about the way she stood there, so still, made me think she wasn't imagining anything. I kneeled down, and she looked at me with those big eyes. "He says you need to come closer." I didn't want to, but I did it anyway. I crawled under the porch, flashlight in hand, trying to look calm, trying to make sense of everything. There was nothing there, not at first, just dirt, leaves, and the smell of decay. But as I was about to stand up, something shifted in the shadows. I heard it again, the laugh. This time it wasn't quiet. It was sharp and real, echoing off the wooden beams. And then I saw it. Something moving. Something thin and dark, crawling just out of reach, its shape too wrong to understand. I scrambled back, my heart pounding, but I felt something cold and wet brush against my neck. "Jack," Emma whispered from behind me, and I heard her voice crack. "Jack says he's coming." I didn't look back. I didn't care. I just ran, pulling Emma with me, slamming the door behind us. I didn't stop until we were inside, locked away, safe from whatever it was out there. The rest of the day was a blur. I couldn't shake the image of that thing, the shape moving in the shadows under the porch. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it wasn't Jack. Not the way Emma described him. Whatever it was real, and it wasn't friendly. Later that evening, I checked under the porch again, determined to find something, anything, that would make sense of this. I wasn't going to leave it unknown, but when I looked under there, there was nothing. No shadow, no sign of anything at all. I don't know what happened that day. I don't know what Emma saw or what was under the porch. But it wasn't Jack. Jack didn't warn me. He didn't play games. What I felt wasn't just an imaginary friend. It was something darker. Something that had been waiting for far too long. We moved out of that house shortly after. Story 2. I wasn't used to things like this happening in my house, but after that night, I can't deny it anymore. I'm still not sure what to make of it, honestly. I live in a small town upstate, not much going on around here except for the woods and the occasional deer crossing the road. My daughter Ava was only a few months old at the time, and my son Eli was around 3 years old. He was your typical curious toddler, always talking to things that weren't there. Imaginary friends, I figured. It's normal at that age. His usual companions were Monkey Boy and the Cowboy. They were constant topics of conversation, but he never seemed to be scared of them. Not until one night. It was late, close to 1 a.m. I was asleep in my room when I heard Eli screaming. It wasn't the usual wake-up screaming. This was different, pure terror. I rushed into his room, half-dazed, only to find him standing in the corner, pointing at the shadowy space near his window. His face was pale, tears streaming down his face, and his small body trembled like a leaf in the wind. "Eli, baby, what's wrong?" I said, rushing over to him, but he just kept pointing at the corner. His voice was barely a whisper between sobs. "Monkey boy, he's bad, Mommy. He's really bad." I didn't know what to think. I'd never heard him say anything like this about Monkey Boy before. I always thought those imaginary friends were cute. His little fantasy world. Harmless. But this felt wrong. I picked him up and carried him into my bed. I tried to calm him down, telling him everything was fine, but he just clung to me like I was the only thing keeping him grounded in reality. I didn't sleep much that night, staring at the corner of his room, my mind racing with questions. The next day, I thought it was just a nightmare. Kids have them, right? But the unease lingered. The moment he woke up, Eli immediately asked, "Is Monkey Boy still here?" "Of course not, sweetheart," I said, trying to keep things normal. "You're safe now." That should have been the end of it. I tried to push it out of my mind, but something kept nagging at me. Every time I walked past his room, I felt like I was being watched. But it wasn't until a few days later, when we were out for a walk, that things took another strange turn. Eli was walking beside me, and Ava was in her stroller. We were just out for a simple stroll, nothing special, but Eli kept saying things under his breath. At first, I didn't think much of it. Maybe he was talking to his invisible friends again, right? Kids do that, but then it got more frantic. "Ow, stop it! Please stop!" he said, his voice starting to shake. I glanced over my shoulder. No one was there. It was just us and the empty street. "Eli, who's hurting you?" I asked, my voice sharp with concern. He stopped walking for a moment, then looked up at me with wide eyes, his face pale. "The cowboy's hurting me, Mommy." I froze. I couldn't explain it. I didn't know what to say. The cowboy? He'd never mentioned anything like this before. Not in any detail. I knelt down, trying to get his attention. "There's no cowboy, Eli. You're fine. There's no one here." But Eli shook his head vigorously, his little hands clutching the straps of his backpack like he was trying to hold himself together. "No, Mommy," the cowboy in my head. "He's hurting me." His voice cracked on the last word, and that was when I realized how serious he was. It wasn't just a game for him. I felt that creeping chill down my spine. It wasn't the air. It wasn't the usual harmless chill you feel on an evening walk. This was something different, something cold and heavy, like the weight of something watching us, lingering just out of view. I turned around quickly, scanning the empty street, but there was nothing. Just the quiet hum of the town, the distant rustle of the trees. No cowboy, no monkey boy. Nothing but the feeling of being utterly alone, except we weren't alone. My stomach twisted. I picked Eli up without another word and quickly started walking back to the house. I could feel the hairs on the back of my neck standing up, like someone or something was following us. I kept glancing behind me, half expecting to see a tall, shadowy figure emerging from the trees or the street, but there was nothing. Nothing but silence. When we finally got back inside, Eli seemed calmer, but there was still something off about him. His eyes were wide and he wouldn't stop glancing toward the corner of the living room. Every few seconds, his head would snap back in that direction, like he saw something I didn't. I didn't say anything, but I could tell he was still scared. That night after I put him to bed, I sat in the living room trying to relax, but I couldn't shake the feeling that something wasn't right. It felt like the whole house was holding its breath. I didn't sleep much, not after what Eli said. The cowboy in his head? What did that even mean? The next morning, everything seemed fine again. Eli didn't mention anything about the cowboy. He was back to his usual self, running around the house, playing with his toys. But every now and then, he'd stop and stare at the corner of the room, his gaze fixed on something only he could see. It was like he was waiting for something, but nothing happened after that. Nothing that I can explain. Maybe I was just being paranoid. Maybe it was just a strange phase Eli went through. But to this day, when I look at the corner of that room, I can't help but feel the same cold weight pressing against me. And every time Eli talks about his imaginary friends, I can't help but wonder, what if some things aren't imaginary after all? What if there's something else? Something far worse? And I'll never really know what happened that night. I'll never know who or what Eli was talking about. But I know one thing for sure. I'll never be able to look at that corner the same way again. Story 3. It's funny how people brush off stories like these, like they're nothing more than childhood fantasies. But when I think about it, what my cousin told me about her imaginary friend still sends chills down my spine. It happened when we were kids, maybe 8 or 9, and my family was visiting her for the weekend. We stayed in this old house on the outskirts of town, an old farmhouse, the kind that creaks when the wind blows, with the kind of warmth you only get from years of lived-in history. The kind of place where shadows don't just exist, they lurk. I remember sitting on the couch in the living room, just talking and playing board games while the adults were in the kitchen. And that's when my cousin, let's call her Megan, started telling me about her friend. It was so matter-of-fact, so innocent, like she was just telling me about a pet or something, but I couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. "Her name's Daisy," Megan said, casually flipping through a magazine. "She used to live in the fireplace." I blinked, unsure if I'd heard her right. "What?" "Daisy," she repeated, like it was the most normal thing in the world. "She's red and patchy, like she was burnt. She looks like she was wearing old-timey clothes, like from when you were in black and white pictures." I stared at her, confused. "Wait, what? You mean like a ghost?" Megan shook her head, her face still calm, but her eyes wide like she was just stating a simple fact. "Number, she's not a ghost. She's just my friend." I didn't know what to make of it. Kids say weird things all the time, but something about how serious Megan sounded made me uncomfortable. It wasn't like she was playing pretend. It felt like she was actually talking about someone real. That's when the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. A little later, when I was alone with Megan in the living room, I asked her about Daisy again. She told me Daisy lived in the fireplace, and if I looked closely, I might be able to see her. Of course, I thought she was just being weird. But then Megan's tone dropped lower, and she got all quiet, her eyes fixed on the fireplace, as if she was waiting for something to happen. "She's a little girl," Megan said, her voice low. but she's not like other little girls. She doesn't talk to anyone except me, and sometimes she gets mad. I couldn't hold back my unease. What do you mean? What happens when she gets mad? Megan's voice was barely a whisper now. She makes the whole house cold, and you hear her laughing, but not like a normal laugh. It's scary. The room went silent for a long moment, and I swear, I could feel the temperature drop, even though the fire was still burning. I tried to shake it off, but there was something about the way Megan said it that made it feel real. Later that evening, when the grown-ups were off talking, and we were supposed to be in bed, Megan insisted on showing me the fireplace. I didn't really want to go, but I followed her anyway, mostly out of curiosity. We stood in front of the old soot-stained stone fireplace, and I could feel the cold air wrapping around me. Megan knelt down and, without saying a word, reached into the dark recesses of the chimney. Her hand moved as though she was tracing something. Then she stood up slowly, a strange, wide smile creeping onto her face. "She's here," Megan said, her voice strangely high-pitched. I stepped back, feeling a lump form in my throat. I didn't see anything, just the darkness of the fireplace. But that's when I heard it, a faint sound at first like the rustling of fabric, followed by a low, slow giggle. It wasn't the playful giggle of a child. It was cold, like someone who didn't know how to laugh, but was trying to mimic it. Megan's face went pale and her eyes went wide, locking onto something in the darkness. "Daisy's upset," she whispered. "She doesn't like you here." Before I could respond, a loud crack echoed through the room, like something heavy had shifted inside the fireplace. Megan didn't flinch. She just stood there staring into the darkness. But I was frozen, my feet glued to the floor. The air around us felt thick, heavy, almost suffocating. I could hear breathing, raspy, like someone had just run a long distance. But I couldn't tell where it was coming from. My pulse started to race, and I had this overwhelming urge to run, to leave, to get away from whatever was in that room. Then suddenly the laughter came again, sharper this time. It wasn't just a giggle anymore. It sounded like someone, something, was growling under its breath, muffled and angry. Without thinking, I grabbed Megan's arm. "We need to go. Now." She didn't move. Her hand was still outstretched toward the fireplace, and her eyes were wide, unblinking. I shook her, but she didn't respond. That's when I saw it, a small red figure, just a shadow at first, but growing larger. It was there, standing in the fireplace, but it wasn't a child. It looked wrong, its limbs twisted, its face burned and disfigured, but still wearing those old-fashioned clothes. The giggle came again, louder now, echoing around the room. I ran. I don't know how I got out of there, but I remember grabbing Megan and pulling her away from the fireplace, dragging her down the hallway, out of the room. I didn't stop until we were in the kitchen, breathless and shaking. My heart was pounding in my chest and I couldn't look back. That night I didn't sleep. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw that thing, Daisy or whatever it was, standing in the fireplace staring at me. I could still hear that horrible laugh, like it was ringing in my ears. Story 4. We just moved into the house. Well, it wasn't really a house. More of a duplex. Small, cramped, but enough space for me, my wife, and our daughter. She was barely 3 at the time, a quiet kid who liked to color or sit by the window and watch the world outside. But for the first few months, she started mentioning a man. We thought it was just an imaginary friend, something toddlers do, so we didn't think too much of it. It started innocently enough. She'd talk about Don in this way that sounded almost too casual, like she'd known him her whole life. He wasn't ever around when we asked her to point him out, but she always spoke about him like he was right there in the room with us. She described him the same way every time. A tall man with a dark hat, a thin mustache, and old-fashioned clothes, like something out of a black-and-white movie. It wasn't anything too creepy at first. She'd talk about him like he was just another part of her day, but after a while it started to get under my skin. One evening, my wife was putting her to bed. I was in the living room when I overheard their conversation. "Mommy, Don said I'm not allowed to play with you anymore." My heart froze. I knew she wasn't talking about some kid she'd met at daycare. She hadn't been in daycare, and we didn't know anyone named Don. Why? My wife asked. Because I didn't listen to him. She said it matter-of-factly, as though it wasn't a big deal. My wife tried to brush it off, but that wasn't the last time she'd talk about Mean Don. After that, she became more distant. She started talking about him more often, but it wasn't the same kind of conversation. It was darker. One night after dinner, she wouldn't go to the bathroom by herself. I was in the living room, reading a book, when I heard her start crying from the hallway. I rushed over, but when I opened the door to the bathroom, she was standing there, staring at the corner, wide-eyed. He told me not to come out. Her voice was barely above a whisper. I tried to calm her down, but she wouldn't budge. She refused to go anywhere in the house alone. She clung to my wife or me constantly. When we asked her why, she said she couldn't go into certain rooms because Don was there, and he didn't like it when she went near the door. At this point, we were both worried. I didn't know what to think. Imaginary friends are one thing, but the way she spoke of Don, so matter-of-fact, so clear, felt real. The more she talked about him, the more I started to feel like something was wrong. Like this wasn't just a figment of her imagination. The situation reached its peak one night, just before we were getting ready to put her to bed. I had stepped into the kitchen to grab something when I heard her scream. I ran out of the kitchen and down the hallway toward her room. My wife was already there, holding her, trying to calm her down. "What happened?" I asked, my heart pounding. "She saw him," my wife said, her voice shaky. She turned to our daughter. "Where was he?" "In the hallway," my daughter said, her voice trembling. "He was standing there. He said I'm not allowed to be here anymore." That was the first time I felt real dread. I tried to shake it off, but something about the way she described him, that image of him standing at the end of the hall, the man with the dark hat and thin mustache, it felt too vivid, too real. The next few days were the worst. She wouldn't sleep in her own room, wouldn't go anywhere without us. She'd cling to me, refusing to go outside even during the day. It was as though she couldn't escape him. At one point, I was holding her, and she said, "Don's in the bathroom. He's watching me." I ran to the bathroom and checked every corner, but it was empty. I didn't know what to say. I couldn't see anything, but she swore Don was there, hiding in the shadows just out of view. That's when things took a darker turn. One night, after we had put her to bed, I stayed up late working. My wife had already gone to sleep. The house was still, and the only noise was the hum of the fridge. I don't know why, but I felt this weird pull to check on her, so I went down the hallway toward her room. I was halfway there when I heard it, a soft, slow tapping. It wasn't like a knock. It sounded more like fingers drumming on a surface. The noise was coming from her room. I froze, listening. It was too late for anyone else to be awake. The tapping stopped suddenly, and I felt my stomach drop. Slowly, I pushed open the door to her room, expecting to see her asleep. But she wasn't in her bed. I scanned the room, and that's when I saw her. She was standing in the corner, her back turned to me, her arms by her side. Her head was tilted, like she was listening to something. I felt the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. "Sweetheart," I whispered, afraid to startle her. She didn't respond. I took a step closer. "Are you okay?" She slowly turned her head to look at me. Her eyes were wide, staring straight ahead, but it was like she wasn't really seeing me. She spoke in this hollow tone, like someone else was using her voice. "Don says you're not supposed to be here." I couldn't move. I didn't know what to do. "What are you talking about?" I whispered. Her eyes locked onto mine, but there was something cold in them. Something wrong. "He's not happy with you," she said. Her voice was soft, almost like a hiss. I rushed toward her, but before I could reach her, she bolted out of the room. I chased her down the hallway, but she was too fast, too frantic. She ran straight to the bathroom, slamming the door behind her. I banged on the door, calling her name, but she wouldn't answer. I turned the doorknob, locked. I forced the door open, and there she was, standing in front of the mirror, staring at herself, her expression blank. When I asked her what she was doing, she didn't reply. She just kept staring into the mirror, like she was waiting for something. I couldn't take it anymore. I grabbed her and carried her back to her room. I stayed with her all night, holding her tight. I couldn't explain what had just happened, but whatever it was, it felt real. The next day, we started looking at other houses, and that's when it stopped. As soon as we moved, she never mentioned Don again. Not once. It was like he had never been there. Story 5. I live in Oregon, out in a quiet suburb near Gresham. My house backs up to woods. Just enough trees to block your view, but not enough to really call it forest. I work in auto parts distribution. My wife teaches second grade, and we've got one son, Oliver. He's 4 now, but this happened when he was 2.5. Still in a crib, still barely forming sentences. It's one of those things you keep buried because saying it out loud makes it worse. But if I don't get it off my chest, I'll start wondering if it never really happened at all. This happened one night in January. Cold, damp, miserable weather. We just moved Oliver into his own room a few weeks earlier. He was doing okay, a little clingy at night, but nothing weird. That night I was in the kitchen cleaning up after dinner, and my wife Ashley was grading papers at the dining table. Nothing unusual, just another weekday. Around 8:30, we did the bedtime routine. Bath, teeth, a couple books, lights out. We had a baby monitor, of course. Not video, just the old audio kind with the little green lights that flash with sound. We kissed him goodnight, turned on the nightlight, left the door cracked, and went back downstairs. About 20 minutes later, I thought I heard him talking. Not crying, not yelling, just talking. I leaned in, listened. It was quiet for a few seconds. Then I heard him say clear as day, "No, Purple Mommy, Daddy stays." I remember stopping, dish towel in hand, just listening. I looked over at Ash and she looked at me like, "Did he say what I think he said?" I tried to make light of it. "Imaginary friend already? That's advanced." Ashley didn't laugh. "Purple Mommy?" she said. "Why purple?" I went upstairs quietly, stood outside his door, listened. Nothing, just light breathing. I poked my head in. Oliver was lying down, eyes open, facing the wall. I whispered, "You okay, bud?" He didn't turn around, just said, "She's gone now." "What?" "She said you were too loud." I walked in, switched the nightlight brighter. "Who said that?" He sat up slowly and pointed at the corner of the room behind the closet door. "Purple Mommy, she doesn't like you." Now I know how kids are. They make stuff up. They hear things from TV. They mash dreams into reality. But this didn't feel like that. He wasn't playing. He looked pale, kind of sweaty. He wasn't crying, but his voice was flat, serious. "Buddy, are you pretending?" He shook his head and looked at me dead on. "She picks me up when it's dark. She takes her head off to see better. She says she can fit through the wall if she takes it off." I didn't respond right away. I just stared at him. My heart did that thing where it feels like it misses a beat. "Where is she now?" I asked. "She left when you came in," he said. Then he smiled a little and whispered, "She's behind you." I turned around instantly. Nothing there. Closet door closed. I felt this wave of cold, like a freezer door open behind me. But there was no draft, no window open. I checked. I don't know what came over me, but I scooped him up and told him he could sleep in our room. Ashley didn't question it. She could see something was wrong. Here's where things go off the rails. Around 2:45 a.m., I woke up. The bedroom was dark, pitch black, like the power had gone out, but it hadn't. I could hear the white noise machine. I could hear the dog shifting in her bed. But Oliver wasn't next to me. I sat up, called his name, no answer. Panic hit me so fast I felt my chest tighten. I ran down the hall to his room. The light was off, completely off, nightlight unplugged, and Oliver was standing in the crib. Not crying, not talking, just standing there staring at the wall, facing the corner. "Oliver," I said, stepping in. He didn't respond. I got closer and saw that he was trembling, his hands gripping the crib rail so tight his knuckles were white, and his pajamas were damp. Not like he'd wet them, but wet like he'd been out in the rain. I picked him up and he whispered, "She wanted to show me her mouth." I looked at him. "What?" "She said she found it under her bandages, but she didn't want you to see." That's when I noticed the closet door was wide open. It's one of those accordion-style doors that we always kept shut because the hinges stuck. I tried to shut it again, but it wouldn't budge, like it was jammed from the inside. I didn't force it. I took Oliver back to bed with us. He didn't say anything else that night, fell asleep holding on to my shirt like he was scared I'd disappear. In the morning, we found three long scratches on the inside of the closet door, parallel, low to the ground, about the height of a crouched adult. I measured them. And the baby monitor? It had been unplugged. The power cord was still in the outlet, but the actual unit had been yanked out and placed upside down under the crib. We didn't talk to Oliver about Purple Mommy again. We changed rooms, put him back in with us for a while. He never brought her up again on his own, but for weeks he refused to sleep without the lights on. Full lights, not nightlight. And the weirdest thing, he kept saying, "She doesn't like Daddy. She says you're too loud." I've checked the windows, the locks. The baby monitor was replaced with a video one. Nothing's happened since. But I swear to you that night, whatever he saw, whatever came into that room, it wasn't pretend. I don't care if it sounds insane. Kids don't make up that kind of detail. And I still have the closet door. I couldn't bring myself to throw it out. It's in the garage, leaned up behind some shelves, with the scratches still there, looking fresh. Story 6. I live in Vermont, up near Barr, and this happened when I was 17. I was staying over at my aunt's place while my parents were out of state for a week. Her house is old, like creaky floors, uneven walls, smells like a basement all the time kind of old. You could feel how long it had been standing. Generations had passed through it. It wasn't haunted or anything dramatic, just off. You know what I mean? Anyway, my cousin Sadie was 9 at the time. She was a quiet kid, barely talked unless you pulled the words out of her. But every now and then, she'd say weird things, stuff you'd write off as imagination if it didn't leave you feeling so cold. The creepiest one was this thing she'd say about Harold. She'd mentioned him the first night I stayed there. I was brushing my teeth and she came into the bathroom, stood behind me in the mirror, and said real soft, "You should shut the door. Harold doesn't like the hallway mirrors." I just kind of stared at her like, "What?" And she looked totally serious. That blank, unnerving seriousness only kids can pull off. "Who's Harold?" I asked. She shrugged. "He lives in the picture frames." Their whole hallway upstairs was lined with old photos, like dozens. School portraits, old black and white ones of ancestors, wedding photos, all kinds. I remember walking past them to get to my room and noticing how she'd hold her breath the whole way. Like, literally puff up her cheeks and power walk. I didn't think much of it at first. I mean, kids are weird. Imaginary friends are part of growing up, right? But then came the basement. It was the third night I was there. Aunt Jenna had gone to a work dinner, so it was just me and Sadie. We made popcorn and watched some cartoons. Around 9, she got up and said she was going downstairs to get her blanket. I told her I'd come with, mostly because I didn't like her being down in that basement alone. It was unfinished, cold, always smelled damp. The kind of place where you automatically check over your shoulder. We went down together. I flicked the light switch, but one of the bulbs had blown, so only half the space lit up. The back corner, furthest from the stairs, was still in shadow. The blanket was tossed on an old armchair in the middle of the room, so I grabbed it, turned to head back up. That's when she pointed. We were halfway back to the stairs when Sadie suddenly stopped, turned, and pointed at the far back beam, this thick vertical wooden post that helped support the floor above. She said it super casually, like she was pointing out a toy or a piece of furniture. "That's where Harold sleeps." I stopped walking. "What?" She didn't look at me, just stared into that corner like she was waiting for something to move. "He sleeps standing up," she said, "like bats do. But he opens his eyes." There was no joking in her voice, no grin, just that weird, childlike neutrality. I looked into the corner, squinting. Nothing. Just shadows. The edge of the concrete wall. Some stacked boxes. Then she added, "He says he likes when people come down here. He watches them breathe." I wanted to get out of there. I told her, "Come on," and pulled her toward the stairs. She didn't fight me. But right before we got to the top, she said, "Don't turn off the light. Harold doesn't like that." I left the light on. I don't know why. I told myself it was just so she'd feel better. But I didn't like how quiet the house felt afterward. I sat on the couch, tried watching TV, but I kept glancing toward the hallway. All those framed photos. I started to notice how none of the eyes in those pictures ever seemed to catch the light. Later that night, I was in bed scrolling my phone when Sadie screamed. It wasn't just a scared kid scream. It was a deep, panicked, something's wrong scream. I bolted out of bed and ran to her room. She was standing on her bed crying, pointing at her closet. "He came out," she sobbed. "Harold came out." I froze at the door. "The picture," she yelled. "He climbed out of the picture and came in here. I saw him." She was hysterical. I ran over, grabbed her, told her it was just a nightmare, just a dream. She was shaking all over. "Where's Aunt Jenna?" she kept asking. "Why did you let the light go off downstairs?" I told her the light was still on. I'd left it on, like she said. She shook her head. "Number, I heard it." I heard the click. That's when I remembered. When I'd gone to bed, I'd heard something too. This soft click, like a light switch flipping. I thought it was the fridge or maybe one of the old radiators knocking. I carried her into my room. We slept with the lamp on. The next morning I checked the basement. Light was off. The switch was flipped. And near the beam, right at the base where the concrete met the wood, was this dark smudge. Like someone had stood there with wet feet or something. It wasn't big, maybe the size of a human heel, but it wasn't there before. I know it wasn't. I would have noticed it when she pointed. I didn't say anything to my aunt, just told her Sadie had a nightmare. But that night, I moved all the picture frames in the hallway, put them face down in a storage bin. My aunt noticed and asked what I was doing, and I told her they were creeping me out. She just laughed. I never stayed in that house overnight again. Sadie doesn't talk about Harold anymore. I asked her once years later, when she was 12. She just said, "He left after you moved the pictures. He got mad, but he left." Then she added, "He didn't like you." And I've never looked at picture frames the same way since. Story 7. We live in rural Pennsylvania, about 20 minutes outside Scranton, where the trees outnumber the people, and the nights feel way too dark. I'm a single dad, raising my daughter Ivy on my own since her mom died 2 years ago. Ivy's 5 now, bright kid, super imaginative, loves to draw, tell stories, and invent characters. So when she started talking about her friend Jenny, I didn't think anything of it at first. She said Jenny lived in her closet. That alone didn't raise any red flags. I mean, kids have imaginary friends, right? I remember having one when I was a kid, but Ivy was different about it. Very specific. Jenny wasn't a made-up cartoon or a fantasy animal. Ivy described her as a little girl with no shoes and black feet. That's how she worded it. She'd say stuff like, "Jenny doesn't like the light," or "Jenny says she lives where it's quiet." Harmless enough until it wasn't. I never saw anything myself. That's part of what made it so messed up. There wasn't some obvious haunting or objects moving around. It was just Ivy talking to that closet like someone was actually in there. And sometimes, late at night, I'd hear her whispering. Not just babbling or singing herself to sleep. Actual whispering, like she was having a full-on conversation. One night, I remember because it was the day before her kindergarten orientation. I was in the living room, flipping channels, and I heard her call for me. "Daddy?" I paused the TV. "Yeah, baby." Silence. I waited a second, then got up and went to her room. Her lamp was off. That was weird because she always wanted it on. She was sitting up in bed, covers pulled up to her neck, staring across the room, at the closet. "You okay?" I asked. She didn't look at me, just nodded slowly. "Did you call me?" She shook her head. "I thought I heard you say, Daddy." "I didn't," she said, still looking at the closet. "Jenny did." I smiled, trying to make light of it. "Oh, did she now? Well, tell Jenny it's bedtime." That's when Ivy finally looked at me. She wasn't smiling. She said, "You're not supposed to go in there." "In where?" "The closet." I walked over to it. I wasn't trying to be dramatic. I just figured maybe something was spooking her. Maybe a shadow, or some clothes hanging weird. I pulled the string and opened the door. Nothing. Just toys, some shoes, and her old winter coat balled up in the corner. I turned back to Ivy. "See? Nothing scary." She was still watching me, but now her lips were pressed tight together. Her fingers were clenched on the blanket. That night I didn't sleep well. Not because of anything that happened, nothing did, but because of this heavy feeling I couldn't shake. Like I'd done something wrong just by opening that door. It sounds nuts, I know. But that room felt off. 2 nights later, things got worse. It was around 2:30 in the morning. I woke up suddenly, not to a sound, but to this cold feeling, like the room had dropped 10 degrees. I sat up in bed, rubbed my eyes, and listened. The house was dead quiet. Then I heard Ivy scream. Not cry, not whimper, scream. I was out of bed in 2 seconds flat, sprinting down the hallway. Her door was wide open. She was standing on her bed, pointing at the closet. "She's in there," she shrieked. "She's in there." She was crawling out. I scooped her up, heart going a million miles an hour. She was shaking so hard I could feel her teeth chatter against my shoulder. I looked at the closet, door wide open. I swear to God I had closed that door earlier. I had even tied a string around the knob to keep it from swinging open because Ivy said it scared her. The string was snapped, not untied, snapped. I backed out of the room with her still in my arms and brought her to my bed. She cried herself to sleep. I stayed up all night sitting at the edge of the bed with a baseball bat in my lap, staring at the hallway like some lunatic. The next morning, I asked Ivy to tell me exactly what she saw. She was quiet at first, picking at the hem of her pajama shirt. Finally, she said, "Jenny's not a little girl." I waited. "She pretends to be, but she's not." I crouched in front of her. "What do you mean, baby?" She had the girl face, but her arms were too long. They touched the floor when she crawled. And her mouth was like this. Ivy opened her mouth wide and pulled her lips back in a way that made my stomach turn. "She was smiling at me when I woke up," she said. "She was halfway out of the closet." I didn't know what to say. What do you even say to something like that? I packed a bag and drove us to my sister's place that afternoon. We didn't go back for a week. When we did, I moved Ivy's room to the opposite side of the house, and I sealed the old closet shut. I mean it. Wooden boards, screws, furniture in front of it. I didn't care how crazy it looked. It's been 6 months. Ivy doesn't talk about Jenny anymore. Story 8. I've never told this to anyone outside my family, and to be honest, I try not to think about it much. But sometimes I catch a glimpse of the color green in the wrong kind of light, and my stomach turns like I'm going to throw up. I'm 32 now. I work maintenance at a school in Flagstaff, Arizona. I don't believe in ghosts, not officially, but what happened when I was 12 still knots me up, and it all started with my niece and a corner of the house she wouldn't go near. My brother had just bought this split-level place after his wife got a job at the hospital in Kingman. He let me live with them for a while so I could go to a better school and help out with the kids. It wasn't a creepy-looking house or anything, just beige stucco and creaky stairs. But my youngest niece, Emma, who was 4 at the time, refused to go near this one corner of the family room. She said a lady lived there, a green lady. She didn't say much else at first, just that the lady didn't like when people looked at her or walked too close to her corner. She'd cry if you even tossed her toys in that direction. My older niece, Riley, thought it was hilarious and used to chuck dolls over there just to mess with her. I remember once Riley asked her, "Is the green lady your friend?" And Emma shook her head and whispered, "She watches me when you sleep." That gave me a chill, not gonna lie. But kids say weird stuff, right? You just nod and move on. Then one day Riley crossed the line. She shoved Emma, actually shoved her, right into that corner. Not playfully either. I saw it happen. Emma slammed into the wall and just froze. I was across the room eating a bowl of cereal, and the second she landed there, she went dead quiet. For a second. Then she screamed. I mean screamed. It was like nothing I've heard before or since. Like her lungs were tearing apart. She didn't even try to run. She was just backed up into the corner, with her arms stiff at her sides, eyes wide open, staring upward. Not at Riley, not at the wall, upper, and she just kept screaming. I dropped my bowl. Riley backed off like she'd touched fire. Everyone in the house came running, thinking she was hurt. We thought maybe she'd seen a spider or something, but no, she wouldn't stop. Not until my brother picked her up and physically carried her out of the room. She peed herself. That's how scared she was. After that, none of us made fun of her anymore. Riley never threw another toy in that direction. Hell, we stopped even sitting on that side of the couch. Friends would come over and we'd just casually say, "Yeah, don't stand over there. That corner's got bad vibes." We treated it like a joke. But we didn't really think it was a joke. Things escalated after that. Emma started saying the Green Lady moved sometimes. Not all the time. Just when she was mad. My brother and his wife were talking about moving to a different neighborhood closer to work. And Emma got real quiet one night and told her mom, "She heard you. Now she's in your room." I didn't believe it, but her mom started sleeping with a nightlight again, and she's a grown-ass woman. Then came the night I really stopped pretending it was nothing. I remember it because I couldn't sleep. I was on the bottom bunk in the room I shared with Riley. I had headphones in, but no music was playing. I'd forgotten to charge my iPod, so I was just lying there, eyes closed, kind of zoning out. Then I heard it, bare feet, slow steps on the carpet outside the room. I figured it was Emma going to the bathroom, but the steps stopped right outside our door. I opened my eyes. The hall light was on. We always kept it off. Then I heard Riley whisper from the top bunk, "Emma, stop." I sat up. "She in here?" Riley didn't answer. I looked up and saw her head poking out from her blanket. She was looking at the door, not me. I turned to look too. The door was open about halfway. And behind it, just barely peeking around, was a sliver of green. It wasn't a glow. It wasn't a shadow. It was like fabric, like the hem of a long dress. But it shimmered slightly, like fish scales or algae. I stood up. "Emma?" I called. No answer. Just a weird creaking sound, like weight shifting. I went to the door and opened it wide. Nothing was there. I checked the hallway. Nothing. I checked the bathroom. Empty. Then I noticed something that made my whole body feel like ice. There were damp footprints leading from the end of the hallway to our door. Bare feet, small ones, like a child's, but too long, like stretched. I followed them down the hall. They ended at Emma's door. I opened it. Emma was standing up in her bed, eyes wide open, looking at the corner of her ceiling, just staring. I didn't say a word. I just backed out of the room and went to get my brother. He found her the same way, standing, wide-eyed, unblinking. She didn't respond to her name. She didn't blink for over a minute. She was like that the entire night. The next morning, she didn't remember any of it. But she did say this over breakfast. She didn't want Riley to leave. That's why she came to our room. We hadn't even talked about Riley going anywhere. But the night before, my brother had said maybe I should switch rooms with her so I'd have more space. That day, we packed up and went to stay at my grandparents' place. My brother never finished out his mortgage. We left most of the furniture behind, including the couch by the corner. Emma never mentioned the Green Lady again. Story 9. We live just outside of Leeds in one of those old 1950s estates where the houses are all semis, each with a little front garden and a low wall that doesn't do much for privacy. It's quiet. Nothing bad ever really happens here, which is probably why what did happen has stayed stuck in my head the way it has. My son Jamie was 6 at the time, and I was a stay-at-home mom back then. My partner Kev works night shifts as a rail technician. Most evenings after tea, it'd just be me and Jamie winding down. Normal stuff, a bit of TV, bedtime stories, brushing teeth, the usual. The first time Jamie mentioned his imaginary friend, it seemed harmless. He was drawing one afternoon, muttering under his breath. When I asked who he was talking to, he just said, "It's Elliot. He likes my drawings." I didn't think anything of it. Loads of kids that age come up with pretend friends. It's normal, right? Except over the next couple of weeks, Elliot became a bit weird. Jamie said things like, "Elliot doesn't like it when Daddy's home," or, "Elliot says the cat smells bad." Again, I brushed it off. Kids say strange things. They hear something on telly, mix it with their own imagination, and it becomes nonsense. But then came that night. It was a Thursday, I remember, because Kev was off, which was rare. We just finished tea and the three of us were sitting in the living room. Jamie was on the floor with his toys. Kev had nodded off on the sofa. I was folding laundry in the chair by the window. Everything was completely ordinary, until I noticed Jamie was frozen still, not playing, just staring at the hallway. I said, "You all right, love?" He didn't answer straight away, just kept looking past me, into the dark hallway behind the living room door. I turned and looked too, half expecting to see the cat or something. Nothing. That's when he said very softly, "He's in the hall. Elliot." Kev stirred on the sofa but didn't wake up properly. I didn't want to encourage it, but something about Jamie's voice felt off. I asked him, "What's he doing?" Jamie whispered, "He's not coming in because you're here, but he told me to bite you." I blinked at him, not sure I heard right. "What?" "He said to bite your leg so you go away." I let out a nervous laugh, trying not to look unsettled. "That's not very nice, is it?" Jamie looked me dead in the eyes and said, "He doesn't like you. He doesn't like Daddy either." That's when I felt it, the weirdest shift in the air, like it suddenly got heavier. I remember the hairs on my arms stood up, even though the radiator was on full. I didn't say anything to Kev about it that night. I just couldn't explain it without sounding mad. Instead, I rang my mate Carol the next morning. She's into all that cleansing and energy stuff. She didn't laugh. She actually sounded worried. Told me to put salt across the doorways, burn rosemary if I had it, and say a prayer at each door. I felt ridiculous, but I did it. Every doorway, every window. I even whispered a little prayer, even though I'm not religious. The atmosphere lifted. That's the best way I can describe it. The house felt normal again. Warm. Light. Jamie even seemed chirpier that day. He was playing in the living room, giggling to himself. And I was hopeful. I thought, that's that then. But something about it still gnawed at me. Like I was scared to believe it had actually worked. So while Jamie was building a tower out of blocks, I casually asked, "Not seen Elliot in a while. Has he gone home?" Jamie looked up and said, "He's not here." I nodded, relieved. "That's good, love." Jamie smiled a bit. "I'm glad." I was folding away the last of the laundry on the sofa when he said it, just as calm and casual as if he was telling me what he had for lunch. "But he's just out there," I frowned. "Out where?" Jamie pointed to the front window, the one right behind me. I turned, thinking maybe he meant a bird, or the postman, or... But there was no one there, just the garden and the low wall and the street beyond. Then Jamie added, "He's watching us." I stared through the window. The street was empty. No movement, no cars going past, nothing. Jamie kept playing like he hadn't just said the most chilling thing I'd ever heard in my life, like it was normal for something to be standing outside watching us. I didn't even know what to do. I didn't want to scare him, but I sure as hell wasn't going to just ignore it either. I got up and locked the front door, drew the curtains, then I sat down and just stared at him for a bit. He looked totally unbothered. Just back to building his tower like nothing had happened. Story 10. I'll start by saying I'm not one of those people who believes in ghosts or demons or whatever. I work maintenance at a wastewater plant in Oregon. My job's gross, my back hurts, and I fall asleep on the couch most nights with the TV still on. I'm not the type to come up with spooky stories just to scare people. But something happened when I was 10 that I still can't explain. I've only told it once, to my wife, and I wish I hadn't, because now she won't let our daughter sleep alone. We lived in a trailer out near Glide. It was just me and my mom back then. She worked nights at a care home and left me alone a lot. She'd leave dinner on the stove and remind me to lock the door, which I usually didn't. Our nearest neighbor was a quarter mile down the dirt road, and we didn't have a landline. It was isolated and quiet, too quiet. I didn't really have friends. There were only 8 kids in my class, and I was the weird one who smelled like old metal because of my dad's welding tools in the shed. So yeah, I talked to myself, I played pretend, I made up games, and around late fall of that year, I started talking to Cassie. I don't even remember making her up. I just started saying her name one day. I'd whisper things like, "Cassie, wanna play?" Or, "Cassie, it's your turn." That part isn't scary. Kids make up imaginary friends all the time. But I remember the exact night it stopped. It was a Sunday just after Halloween. Mom had left for her shift around 7:30. I'd been watching cartoons and eating candy. At some point, I dozed off on the couch with a Butterfinger in my hand. I woke up needing to pee. The clock said 2:11 a.m. Now the bathroom was on the far end of the trailer, and you had to pass the little hallway by the back door, the one with the coat hooks in the mirror. The trailer didn't have good lighting, and that hallway was always dark. I usually just sprinted past it. But that night, as I got up and started walking, I saw something in the mirror. Not a shadow, not a trick of the light, a girl. She was standing in the hallway, bare feet on the linoleum, wearing this short, old-fashioned dress, dirty white with lace trim. Her hair was hanging in front of her face, long, black, straight. Not like mine, not like anyone I knew. I froze. My legs went stiff. I told myself I was dreaming. I rubbed my eyes hard. When I looked again, she was still there, but she'd moved closer, still standing, still facing the mirror. Only now I could see her arms.
Hi, I'm Tara Schmidt, a registered dietitian and host of On Nutrition, a podcast from Mayo Clinic where we dig into the latest nutrition trends and research to help you understand what's health and what's hype. There's a lot of wild stuff out there, so we'll be keeping it science-based, research-informed, and practical. Mayo Clinic's On Nutrition, new episodes every other week, wherever you get your podcasts.